Welcome to a new podcast series, Purposeful Investments, brought to you by Pension Insurance Corporation, also known as PIC, a specialist insurer of defined benefit pension schemes, taking a look at the powerful financial, regulatory and cultural issues that form the relationship between finance and society. I'm Emma Nelson, and this series is all about finance with a social purpose, how the pensions we save for not only give us a secure financial future, but also positively help the environment, the economy, and future generations. This series looks at ESG, or environmental, social, and governance investing, an evolving framework which is meant to help investors judge the long-term sustainability and social impact of their investments. Today, in our closing programme in this current series, we look at ethics and practice for investors, explore new emerging models, and hear what a government minister has to say.
When you look at the climate crisis, when you look at mass social inequality, a lot of people are rising up and saying the way that capitalism has existed actually isn't benefiting us. What we're saying is actually that the way the economic system works at the moment is driven by shareholder primacy. So if we change the operating system of capitalism, if we look to a more stakeholder view, if we rebalance out the need to create profits for shareholders with people and planet, we'll create a more equitable, inclusive, regenerative economic system.
The lesson that I would take, I think, is a very simple lesson, which is that be aware of all the different factors that bear on decision-making in the financial markets and indeed more generally. And you know, you have a legal structure of incentives, you have an economic structure of incentives, and you have a cultural set of incentives. And if you don't think about all those three at the same time, then you're going to get bad regulation. And what you have tended to see historically is that people have focused on the legal and the economic and ignored the cultural.
There's an old cliche, what gets measured gets managed. And the output of a traditional company reporting accounts or other corporate disclosures does not lend itself to enabling people to think about what the externalities of a business are. So one of the challenges we all have and trustees have is how much of this is hot air and how much of it can genuinely be measured and how much progress can be shown.
Three perspectives from just some of our guests today. That was Kate Sandel, one of the leading voices in the B Corp movement, the Right Honourable Jessie Norman MP, Financial Secretary to the Treasury, and an historian of acclaimed books on Edmund Burke and Adam Smith. And Peter Harrison, the Chief Executive of Schroders Asset Management, who joined me in a round table together with Hugh Van Steenis, Global Head of Strategy and Chair of the Sustainable Finance Committee at UBS. And Tracy Blackwell, CEO of PIC, to begin to dig into the issues we're interested in. I began by asking Tracy whether, when it comes to ESG, we might pay attention to some bits more than others.
I think a lot of people are focused on the S and the G, and I just don't think there's potentially as much press about it, as much focus on it. But it is equally, if not more, important, because if you have the G, the governance bit, then the E bit will follow. It comes back to what a company's purpose is and how sustainable, not in environmental terms that a company is, but how sustainable that company is in the long term. So if it has the other bits right as well, the governance bit, the social bit, doing its bit for society, then it will, well, not necessarily, but it will be a more successful company in the future, should be, rather than being very short term in nature. And I think the focus on S&G is absolutely, therefore, just as important. And again, for us, it's important to make sure that our investments are good for the long term.
Peter, we'll go to you on this one. Investments for the long term, many people are saying that actually there's been an awful lot of focus on London investments, whereas actually the political agenda at the moment by the current government is that we should be levelling up. So where are we seeing potential here, or rather lack of incentive or lack of action?
I think the reality is that the levelling up agenda is completely aligned with this. So when you come back to Tracy's point about the S and the social impact of what one's doing, some of the governance impacts about the way businesses are run. The key to this is that they run for the benefit of all of society, not London society. So there's a huge consistency here. I think it is an obligation on finance and on businesses to look across the whole of the environment that they work in, be it the UK and internationally, to deliver. It's not an obligation to deliver for London.
How much has this been a priority in the past with you, Hugh, to focus on areas outside the obvious in your previous work with Mark Carney at the Bank of England, but now at UBS?
Well, look, I think, you know, one of the challenges for investors and for policymakers is to try and keep focused on the medium to long term and not just the sort of day to day in the press. And so for some of the work that I was fortunate to do with Governor Carney was to try and think about how will finance evolve over the next 5 to 10 years and what does that mean? And if you extend the duration to 10 years, then things like environmental change, climate transition, who are the winners and losers from that? Are there going to be so many losers that the banking system or insurance system gets a dead weight of bad debt? It becomes a material issue. So if you extend beyond the today-to-day to the 10 to 15 years. So I think it's that having policymakers who can keep focusing, like investors, on the longer term, I think is this the key focus. Because also, things change quite fast.
Let's move on in that context to the issue of where to find the patient capital, the medium to long-term investment that Hugh speaks of. Tracy, what, 4 out of 5 investors will say happily that they want to get involved in sustainable investment, but there isn't enough so-called patient capital. Could you just explain, first of all, what patient capital is and why you can't find any of it?
Patient capital to me is about long-term investing and investors who think over the long term and don't just think about next year's returns, but think about their returns in the future. And so the irony is the UK is blessed with a very healthily funded pension system. Even though people think it isn't, there are big deficits in the pension system. We're far and away luckier than any other country in terms of having a well-funded pension system. In other countries, those pensions aren't necessarily funded. And we also have a very large insurance sector as well. So both of those have the potential to be very long-term in nature. They're just not right now. So if you look at the amounts, there's £2 trillion in private sector schemes, defined benefit pension schemes, so company pension schemes. Then there's £2 trillion, again, in local authority pension schemes, so public sector schemes. And there's roughly the same again in insurance company balance sheets. That's a huge amount of capital that can be mobilized to do things like build the infrastructure for the economy for the future. But clearly it can't or won't, and there's lots of regulatory reasons behind that, but it's clear to me that asset owners are just not thinking long term. And there's lots of different reasons for that, including regulatory reasons. And each one is completely different. Each sector is completely different. The barriers to long-term investing are completely different, and it needs to be broken down one by one. But there are definitely barriers in regulatory terms, but there's also barriers in terms of knowledge that need to be broken down for all of that to happen.
Just to re-emphasize Tracy's point, I think the single biggest impediment to us addressing ESG in this country is the inability to focus on the very long term. So the structure of the assets we've got, either they're tracking indices and simply passively managed, which is a very large portion of the assets, or they exist with insurance companies where they've got to be invested in fixed income securities, not in equity, is a major, major impediment to doing it. There is an overwhelming desire on part of trustees to simply focus on the returns that are earned rather than on the way in which those returns are earned. And that's partly because there is very poor information about the externalities that businesses create, or there is a regulatory framework which disincentivizes long-term equity investment in favor of short-term volatility management. And we focus on volatility as risk. And volatility in the world that we inhabit, the world the planet inhabits, is not the only risk. And so for me, it's because the knowledge gap is the focus on volatility rather than real economic and climate risk. And that's what's embedded in regulations and trustee thinking. It's such a massive problem. There's an old cliche, what gets measured gets managed. And the output of a traditional company report and accounts or other corporate disclosures does not lend itself to enabling people to think about what the externalities of a business are. So one of the challenges we all have and trustees have is how much of this is hot air and how much of it can genuinely be measured and how much progress can be shown. And I think the more pressure that can be brought on disclosure, the better this will be managed and the better the disclosure will be, and the more we'll allow organisations to focus on longer term measures other than just profit and returns.
So
So profit and returns is a good place to leave the roundtable right now, although we'll return to it at the end and pick up on how others in the financial world are approaching this key social and moral question. Kate Sandel is the Director of Programmes and Engagement at B-Lab UK, a standard policies and tools network mobilising and supporting alternative models of economic systems, such as B Corps, a new certification system with ESG at its core. Kate, explain to us, you've said in the past that the system when it comes to ESG and assets and asset management is broken. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, I think it's taking a bigger picture to this. So when we look at the way the world is moving and the experiences that are happening, so when you look at the climate crisis, when you look at mass social inequality, a lot of people are rising up and saying the way that capitalism has existed actually isn't benefiting us. So we think the root cause of this is shareholder primacy. And what we're saying is actually that the way the economic system works at the moment is driven by shareholder primacy. So if we change the operating system of capitalism, if we look to a more stakeholder view, if we rebalance out the need to create profits for shareholders with people and planet, we'll create a more equitable, inclusive, regenerative economic system.
How do you propose that that works? Because you're asking people to give up an awful lot of what they're used to there.
I don't think it's about giving things up. I think we often within our language and the way that we think, it's a binary thing. It's either or, but actually what about it's a both and? You know, we're not saying that you need to have profit and disrespect your impact on people and planet. We're saying you can do all of that. And I think the track record of ESG investing, which is a very broad, loose term, has demonstrated that. And you've seen that with results that have come out even during COVID. The companies that have preferenced ESG investing have done often the same or if not better than other businesses who haven't necessarily preferenced it. So the way that we've been working and the way that the B Corporation movement has been growing over the last kind of 12 years is that recognizing that as a business, you can still be very successful and depending on how you define success, and also understand your impact that you're having and have a positive and material positive impact on people and planet as a result of operating with a conscious effort of your impact.
How much do you think actually people are willing to go along with this?
So we've seen a great demand. We've actually seen the B Corp movement has grown quite a lot or exponentially over the last couple of years. And especially even in kind of we've been reflecting on COVID and actually thinking about what the impact has been for businesses and a critical time for them and their existence. What are they preferencing and what are they working on?
Could you possibly give me a couple of concrete examples of where you have seen this shift and where people have decided that the asset owners want to take a little bit more control of the performance and the direction of the companies they invest in?
So I think a couple of examples, we have B Corps who are investors from a big spectrum, from Tower Brook, massive private equity fund, to smaller kind of impact investors or Bridges Fund Management, which actually ask all of their investees to go through the B Impact Assessment because they recognise this is a huge opportunity for due diligence to actually understand the business so much better, to understand the risks and the opportunities that exist in the business if you're looking at a broader holistic way of investing.
Now, you are trying to introduce legislation here to make every business report on its environmental and social performance. Explain a little bit more about what that all entails.
So when you certify as a B Corp, it's a two-stage process. So you have to meet a performance requirement and it's in your environmental and social performance. But the second thing you have to do is amend your articles of association. So you change the legal DNA to commit to having a material positive impact, which we verify through your certification. But also you're saying that you will consider stakeholder interests when making decisions. So you will understand the impacts that you're having when you're making bold or strategic decisions within the board. And what we're saying is actually that's really important and that's how business is going to change. So not only does it need to perform in a certain way, but it also needs to ensure that this is embedded into the way the business operates. And so we proposed this, which is an idea that every business should operate like this, that every business should commit to having a material positive impact on people and planet, and that they should report on it. So they should create a report every year to say how they're doing it. And when you think of the way that change happens, it's kind of twofold, right? So often it's legislation that either is trying to catch up and trying to follow the way, or sometimes it's actually a cultural revolution that has led the change. And I think it's a both and. And we're seeing the cultural revolution. We're understanding that citizens, that employees, that business owners want their businesses to be more aligned to their values. And we're seeing that in the growth of the B Corp movement. But actually what we're also seeing is that businesses sometimes need some encouragement to be able to create that change. And the Modern Slavery Act was a classic example of understanding that actually businesses need to take this seriously and start changing the way that they're operating. What we're trying to do is ensure that businesses can, as the most powerful force on the planet, can actually move into a society which is regenerative and inclusive and equitable.
Kate Sandel showing there is real fire in the belly of the B Corp movement. It feels as if momentum is moving her way. On now with a government perspective. A former banker and an economic historian, the Right Honourable Jessie Norman MP is Financial Secretary to the Treasury. So I asked him to frame the debate about assets in an historical context as much as anything else.
Over our history, finance has more generally been blamed for the economic and social problems we've had in the UK rather than been used as part of the cure. There has been a long-standing worry about the difference between what you might call, in what in America would be called mainstream capital, Main Street capital, so capital that goes into businesses, and Wall Street capital, that is to say capital that goes into assets, stocks and shares and the like. And what is interesting is that there appears to be over time a growing belief that finance, far from being a sector of the economy which blows up periodically, socializes the losses and privatizes the gains, might be a sector that could actually be a bit of a leader in this area. We'll have to see if that's true or not, because the jury, I would have said, is very much out. It's an interesting idea, as always with these things, and you don't need to spend much time on Wall Street, as I have done in a previous life, to know this. Money talks and BS tends to walk. So let's just see whether these fine professions that we've seen from some of the biggest names in the industry are matched with actual actions and therefore with change.
Why do you think the jury's out in terms of the amount of benefit that finance has been able to bring to society?
I mean, ESG is a very new idea, right? And historically, you had periodic panics about finance that were brought originally by the fact that when the banking sector went bankrupt, an awful lot of people's money went with it, because historically, and certainly in the 18th century and for chunk of the 19th century, the banking sector carried unlimited liability with it, and therefore people could be taken for the full totality of their net worth if they were investors in a bank that went south. This is what happens to the Duke of Buccleuch, 1772, the air banking disaster, which destroyed the Scottish banking system all but at the time, and took out a large chunk of the circulating capital in Scotland. Why? Because these banks were in way over their heads and the investors had to bail them out. They were legally responsible. Then, of course, 19th century, you get the idea of a corporation as an artificial person, and then you get the idea of a company as having limited liability and the investors in the company as having limited liability. And in a way, although that does give enormous benefits in terms of the fungibility of money and the ability of finance to spread itself and the ability of business to develop without fear of every investor being sent to the poorhouse, it also means that there is a level of power within the private corporation, limited liability company, public corporations it now is, which carries with it a degree of duty and responsibility, not only on the directors, but certainly I have argued in the past on the shareholders. When they own a share in a company, you're owning a piece of property, and all property carries with it obligations as well as rights. It's a very unfashionable view. It's become more mainstream in the last 20 years with the emergence of pension fund ownership and then a very activist shareholder rights movement that's insisted on these shares being voted. And ESG is a kind of extension into other areas of the idea that a company, far from being a corporate entity minding its own business and able to do its own thing by pooling money, irrespective of the privilege that is composed and conferred thereby, might actually have a wider responsibility. And that wide responsibility might go beyond the responsibility to support its own members in this country or in America, as it's often seen, the responsibility to support the shareholders, to being responsibility to support their communities and other wider parts of society, indeed potentially society itself, through its environmental and social goals. And of course, as you'll be aware, there's been a big pushback historically against that. Famously, it was said that the business of America was business. It was once remarked that the business, the only obligation a shareholder has, as it were, or a business has, is the maximization of shareholder profits. And that's the direct contrary to the view. It's never been this country. It's never been the view in this country, by the way. The Companies Act, I don't think, has ever had that requirement. And there's been a pervasive confusion between two things. One is the entitlement that a shareholder has to the residual value of a company when all the other claims have been addressed, and the idea that the company should only be run in the interests of those shareholders because they have the residual claims. And the UK has never believed in the latter view.
The introduction of ESG, to a certain degree, is now forcing people to evaluate their prospects a little. Would you agree with that?
Well, I hope it is, and it may be amongst the best practice, but whether that's true for the vast majority of the money that flows through the capital markets, I would still, I'm afraid, rather doubt. That's why I say that we'll have to see whether actions are matched, words are matched by actions and then actions by outcomes. So I think it's a very early stages of what potentially could be an enormous change in human behaviour. But of course, the key point is that if you are going to have genuinely long-term investment, then you've got to get away from the Wall Street rule that if you don't like a share, you just sell it. You've got to have people actually live with the consequences of owning that share. And at the moment, they only do that if they're in an area that people have decided they want to disinvest from. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing, of course, you have to live with is the idea that we as a country, the major countries, financial countries around the world, are going to have a culture in our financial sectors that is intrinsically long-term, whereas in fact, as matters have worked out, people working in finance typically have a very short-term perspective. And that is why it would be very attractive if, as it were, pension fund ownership were to become the norm or some proxy for pension fund ownership in order to inject some longevity into the capital structure of these companies. And to some extent, that's happening because some of the biggest shareholders are never not going to be invested in the largest companies because of the way in which passive investment has grown over the last 20 years. But it still is the case that the overwhelming culture in the City of London, on Wall Street, in around the major financial capitals of the world, is a what would be considered by industrial terms a very short-term culture indeed.
What about the medium term?
The state is the ultimate risk taker for all of us in many different ways. And when the government encourages investment in pension funds or in other forms of saving vehicle, it's making a judgment about how people's risk is best managed, while recognising that government itself, the taxpayer, remains ultimately on the hook for the long-term safety of the system and therefore for people's longer-term well-being. I suppose the point I would make is that if we can use the green revolution, the environmental side, to get people to think more about what a genuinely long-term financial structure financial institutions would look like, then I think we might be able to use that to as a template or a model for a different way of thinking about capitalism. But a form of capitalism which finance predominates at the moment is always going to have a tremendous impetus towards the short term, and that is a serious problem.
When it comes to looking forward, therefore, what lessons can we learn from the past when it comes to considering any future regulation or behavioural caution?
I mean, I suppose the lesson that I would take, I think, is a very simple lesson, which is that be aware of all the different factors that bear on decision-making in the financial markets and indeed more generally. And you have a legal structure of incentives, you have an economic structure of incentives, and you have a cultural set of incentives. And if you don't think about all those three at the same time, then you're going to get bad regulation. And what you have tended to see historically is that people have focused on the legal and the economic and ignored the cultural. And of course, the strength of finance as a sector within a country, particularly in this country, less so in America, is that historically it's been able to hoover up an enormous amount of the best talent coming out. And it's been able to make very powerful arguments and lobby very effectively in its own behalf with government.
An enormous amount of the best talent. That's a compliment from the Minister, I think, for the city, and an engrossing history lesson. Just before we finish, I'll give the final word to Tracy Blackwell. What, I asked, is her priority?
Oh, well, we're doing what we always do, which is think about the long term. You know, that's what we're here for. We've been waiting for a long time for markets to catch up with the agenda, and they are very quickly.
I'm Emma Nelson, and this has been an Editorial Intelligence production for Pension Insurance Corporation. The executive producers are Jeremy Apfel and Julia Hobsbawm. Assistant producer is Callum McRae, and our editor is George McDonough.